You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 498 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West champion Mariners.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. I was thinking about this and I was like, does this change? Maybe I'm getting way ahead of myself. Does this change at some point?
Well, I think in the scenario where they were to be you could say the NFC West champions because they're actively the NFC West champions. So if they added some new active champions to that, I think it would be appropriate. So, you know, we'll find out soon. Very soon, as we're releasing this podcast later in the week than we typically would. But hope everyone had a chance to listen to our emergency pod breaking down the Seahawks' anticlimactic win over the San Francisco 49ers last Saturday. We did not know at that time who they would be facing in the NFC Championship game, but we knew who they were going to be facing in the NFC Championship game, even when Caleb Williams threw that miraculous touchdown to send the game to overtime. It was always the LA Rams.
Were you watching?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Did you think they should have gone for two?
I mean, I don't like the defenses had such an advantage in that game that I did not think it was probably a good idea to go for two. Because I think your odds of converting the two-point conversion would have been less than they normally are. Does that make sense?
Okay.
I mean, it's a fascinating question to debate, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's easy now after to basically go back and be like, they should have done the thing that would have won them the game.
Right. Whereas had they gone for two and failed, then everyone would be like, Ben Johnson's an idiot. They should have gone to overtime.
Well, and the reality is, if you would have said in that moment, you know that you're not going to go for two, and you can confirm that
you're going to get the ball.
No, that the Rams are going to punt, that they're going to get the ball first and they're going to punt. Right, like the Bears' chances of winning that game had to be pretty high.
Well, let's take a look. I'll go check the win probability on rbsdm.com. Conveniently, this is the game that immediately comes up. So if we go to overtime here, yeah, they were at one point about 70% to win prior to the Cam Curl interception. So, yeah. I mean, the overtime win probability does get a little wonky. It doesn't seem like it handles the third possession scenario exceptionally well. But I do think it was probably the right decision ultimately not to go for it.
The other thing is we're not going to talk about this might come up a little bit later, but like we're not going to talk about the AFC that much at all. But like I think people treated it as if the like Patriots win over the Texans was a little bit more commanding than it was.
Oh, you who were just anticipating the Seahawks-Texans Super Bowl matchup think that have underrated the Houston Texans? That's your position?
Don't forget my bold prediction for the year. That is still in place, right? Everybody is together for my bold prediction.
Wait,
did we
note on the emergency pod that the bold prediction was right?
We did,
right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, my bold prediction is still firmly in place. There's a lot of layers to it, but the main layer is still firmly there.
Your bold predictions are like a seven-layer dip.
Did not involve the best ones are, as many are saying.
you get down through the olives, and then there's the shredded cheese, and then the sour cream, and then it stalls out perhaps around the beef and beans layer.
But I think like it's not determined that CJ Stroud is gonna throwing four interceptions. Was a worse performance than you would have expected from CJ Stroud in that game.
That is certainly the case. The New England Patriots, their defense played
better than they have been playing.
The New England Patriots are now number two in weighted DVOA and we're at home. I think you are underestimating the New England Patriots to a degree.
No, that's not exactly what I'm saying, though. And maybe their defense has been playing better. There was a fumble that the Patriots had. It required a pick six from the Patriots. It required four interceptions, I think five turnovers overall. Five turnovers overall. The Patriots, Drake May lost four fumbles. Do you understand that? Or fumbled the ball four times in that game. Like the way that I saw the game was pretty right. I mean, that one that Will Campbell recovers at like the 4 yard line. If the Texans recover that ball, it is a radically different game. And I think it's sort of what I
you like to cite yards per play in these situations. The Patriots outgained the Texans by 0.6 yards per play. Now both of those numbers are very small.
That's not a significant number. Like basically what that comes down to at 3.9 to 3.3 yards per play is it's turnover luck. And CJ Stroud happened to be throwing the turnovers and Drake May happened to be fumbling them when you get a chance to get them back. Like Drake May is getting a little bit more credit for this victory for somebody who fumbled he fumbled the same amount of times that CJ Stroud threw interceptions.
Buffalo did have a greater yards per play advantage over Denver.
Oh, I think Buffalo outplayed Denver in that game.
I think everyone thinks Buffalo outplayed Denver in that game.
That's what I'm saying. There's
not like a controversial position.
But I guess what I'm saying is people were treating it like it was a little bit more commanding of a victory. It was not easy for the Patriots to beat the Texans at home in weather that was probably more conducive, I guess, to them.
Okay, but like they did. And the weather was a forecastable factor. They literally, you know, tell you what the weather is going to be beforehand. It's one of the things that
did
we're
they tell,
really
good at.
Did
they forecast fumble luck beforehand, too?
They don't forecast that. What was the postgame? Do we have the postgame win expectancy for the Patriots? I'm not seeing that in the... Let's see. It doesn't have the Patriots, but postgame win expectancy. But the fact that they don't have it suggests to me that the Patriots were expected to win. Because they do mention that the Broncos, it was 50-50, essentially. So there you go.
But we knew who we were going to be playing this weekend. Are we going straight into that? We're going to do the toast and then go straight into that.
I think we probably should. You know, obviously people only have a few days to listen to this before Sunday afternoon at 3:30 PM Pacific time when the NFC Championship game kicks off, unless the AFC Championship game goes into overtime and we get a pause as we did last Saturday. All right, let's start with congrats to Seahawks wide receiver Jackson Smith and Jigba, voted the PFWA's Offensive Player of the Year. He was also named a finalist for the AP version of the honor, which is the official NFL award. In addition to JSN, the other Seahawks finalists for those award shows, for those NFL awards, Mike McDonald for Coach of the Year, Clint Kubiak for Assistant of the Year, Nick Emanwori for Defensive Rookie of the Year. Those will be presented at the NFL Honors Show the week of the Super Bowl. So... Drake May, intriguingly, a finalist for Offensive Player of the Year. I haven't looked at how that affected the odds, where JSN was like the overwhelming favorite to win it beforehand.
But I think he's still the overwhelming favorite.
I'm sure he is. And also from the Pro Football Writers Association's awards, congrats to John Schneider, voted the PFWA's Executive of the Year in what was obviously a well-deserved honor. So, you know, John Schneider, we talked about it on the Year in Review podcast, the way that he has transformed this franchise in a short period of time in a way that very few people, nobody on this particular podcast, saw coming.
No, and I think it's almost more shocking that he hasn't won it before. And it's one of those things where you look back where you're like, John Schneider was the architect. Like, literally, if you look back at the initial run that he and Pete had with the way that they constructed the roster, it's like, this feels like even more so than what they've done right now, right? Like, that's the way you would draw it up the most completely. And it's the absolute archetype for how to make a team and find talent deeper in the draft. And that's ultimately kind of what this award is, right? It's finding a way to win games, but especially win games with talent that's not just all first round picks and stuff like that. And that he didn't do that. Did the Broncos end up winning one? Who won during those years?
So 2012 was Ryan Grigson for the Colts, who that season was, that was the year... First Peyton's first year into Denver, right? Because 2013 was the Seahawks Broncos Super Bowl. So the Broncos lost to Baltimore at home in 2012. And then post Peyton Manning, the Colts were very good that season with Andrew Luck as a rookie and et cetera. 2013, when John Schneider put together a Super Bowl team, no award given.
No award given?
Yeah, I don't know what the explanation for this is. But
I mean, that makes sense why he didn't win it, though, I guess.
It does start to make more sense. I assumed that Denver would have gotten it in 2012 for adding Peyton Manning. But Grigson, I suppose, people were very hyped on that one. I agree.
I mean, it's a little bit of like, yeah, you just kind of lucked. You lost Peyton Manning and lucked into the first pick in the draft. Like,
it was
John
also
Schneider,
like they had a lot of other guys as rookies. I agree that that's probably not the way I would see it. Oh, the Pro Football Writers of America did award it. Sorry, that was the Sporting News, which I guess had already given this to John Schneider. Pro Football Writers of America in 2013 gave it to John Dorsey of the Chiefs, who added Alex Smith that season.
And got to fine.
They were better than fine, but yeah, I don't think that one has aged particularly well.
Wow, that's a fascinating one. I mean, Mike Vrabel seems like the overwhelming favorite to win Coach of the Year, which is also one where I'm like, sure. I mean, there's a good chance that these two coaches will possibly meet in the Super Bowl, right? But like, I think what Mike McDonald has done with this roster and this team in 2 years, people are like, oh, they're so talented. It's like they're talented because Mike McDonald has made them seem that way. Like, yes, there is talent across the board from the draft, but
It's hard to
also.
say. But yes, I mean, it's not like people were looking at this roster in September and saying it was overwhelmingly talented. They were saying the opposite.
But also like the DVOA and you know like it's historic. It's not like they're just good, right? It is historic DVOA. And the Patriots, you said they've gotten up to number two and waited now, but it's kind of like we know the schedule. You know what I mean? Like, yes, they have the wins and on their way. Are you unaware of this?
The Patriots had an easy schedule.
Yeah, like
No, what I'm asking is, do you think DVOA is unaware of their schedule?
no, I'm saying that DVOA is aware. I'm saying the betting markets
I see.
that are picking Mike Vrabel, like he's getting the credit because of where they were last year versus this year.
Well, and because he's a first-year coach. I mean, that's at the end of the day a big factor in it.
Mike McDonald's also on his first job too. You know what I mean?
I know,
Like,
but I think people are, they started a certain baseline defensively.
it's
There was
like
a certain defensive expectation built
Billy, he's
for
like
this
Billy Joel
team.
out here. Get it right the first time. You know what I mean?
Okay. Did not expect a Billy Joel reference this early in the pod. Anything more on this?
No, but it's definitely, I mean, again, we were definitely, here's what I will say also is the year that John Schneider had, we were very unimpressed with John Schneider at the end of last season.
Yes.
And I know, I think mostly you, but me also, like the transactions that he made, the offseason that he had, I think we both felt like he put the team in a much better position. I don't think we expected them to be this good, but
No. We thought it was more of like a long-term win that, they.
he did a really good reset with the ability to be good this year.
Yeah. I mean, it's an all-time single-year turnaround without question, I would say. But not in a way that like is not going to age well. To give credit to John Dorsey in 2013, the best move he made that year that did age very well was hiring Andy Reid. That was also his first year with the Chiefs as coach. Okay, also this week.
Pete Carroll sucks. Like what?
Well,
I'm
Pete
just
Carroll
like,
wasn't hired that offseason. So again, it's part of the, we see this a lot on the NBA side where it's even more magnitude, like, what year would Sam Presti be the executive of the year for the Thunder's rebuild? You would say not.
I'd probably say all of them, to be honest.
Yes. But like the Paul George trade
I
happened
look forward to when the
6
draft
years
picks
ago.
run out. Like, there's going to come a time
Yeah.
when the roster is going to get expensive and the draft picks are going to run out. This can't continue forever. But also, who cares?
Well, I'd like to wish a happy 20th anniversary to one of our favorite days ever as sports fans, because it was 20 years ago today, as we record this, that the Seattle Seahawks went to the Super Bowl for the first time,
Hello.
beating the Carolina Panthers.
What day was that? What was the day exactly?
January 22nd.
It's today.
That's why I said it's today.
Wow.
Yes. Many people have been posting because it's on my NBA timeline because it's the 20th anniversary of Kobe Bryant scoring 81 points in a game. But that, of course, only came after. Your
That was
Seattle
part of it, though.
Supersonics. Oh, yeah. But that only came after your Seattle Supersonics beat the Phoenix Suns 152-149 in double overtime with a Ray Allen game winner at the buzzer that we flipped over to after the NFC Championship game and spent that whole day at the house that you and the famous cousin Katie were sharing that college year. So it was a great time.
We've talked about this day a lot, granted, right?
We did the
And
Let's Remember Some Years, yes.
on it. But I do think part of it, I was thinking that this was part of what makes like sports so good and so fun is sometimes the and football in particular is like sometimes it happens when you need it. And like just a gross day in January. Remember, that was the year where it was like it had rained
the longest rain streak. Yeah.
And it was like, we needed that day of sport.
Although that day was actually, even though it rained, obviously, it was quite nice. You'll recall that during the AFC Championship game, we went across the street to Dahl Playfield.
Hello.
The unofficial playfield of the Pelton cast and played basketball.
Now it's the church and the school. Come on.
Yes. We played basketball earlier that day during the AFC Championship.
Look, if ball is life, ball's going to be life. But no, it is like those moments. It was funny also, like the, I guess I'll mention 2K later. But Luca was like, he's like, there weren't any good Sonics teams after the 90s. And I was like, how dare you?
Wow. Offensive.
How dare you say that? And I was like, my favorite sports team, not basketball, not football, not anything. My favorite sports team ever was mid-2000 Sonics. So the 2005 Sonics, there will never be anything more fun. There literally cannot be, in my opinion, anything that is more fun than that. Also, I can't be 20 whatever years old. You know, like
you were 19. You
19 years
20
old.
Right. Oh, yeah. Around when the playoffs,
yeah,
ended.
Yeah, like 19 or 20 years old. Like the combination of all of these things happening at once, the energy of it. I think I'd just
your brother working for the team.
I just got accepted to UW during that spring, right? And I was about to start there the next year, or was I already there?
Oh, yeah. I guess, you know, yeah, you were accepted during that spring, yeah, because 05-06 was your first year.
So I was just about to go to UW, which for me was like this, it was a deal, you know what I mean? Getting in, I was like, I fucking made it. I proved Jan wrong, which, you know, that's the ultimate goal for any of us. And having this Sonics run happen, but I was like, you don't understand what it's like with a basketball team when you expect nothing and you get something. And I think that's really like, I mean, people have talked to death about Indiana, you know what I mean? But like going into this year, the feeling wasn't, this is the best team on the face of the earth. And oh, no. I think the Nebraska basketball team too, like going into the year, I don't know where they're ranked, but it wasn't like we're going to be one of the last undefeateds, I'm assuming.
It wasn't like we're going to be a solid 11th in KenPom.
Whatever. The wins still count. whether they were 11th in KenPom or not, the game last night still counts. So those are the moments where I'm just like, and I feel like the Seahawks team should kind of feel that way, but they're too good. They are too good.
It happened too fast.
The team is just somehow so good that it's not like, it's not David versus Goliath. It's like, well, we're all of it. We're everything. We're the whole fucking sport right now.
Right. IU football. Okay. Well, all right. To talk about non-football for a second here, congrats to Felix Hernandez, who got votes on 46% of Hall of Fame ballots this year, up from 21% in 2025, ranking fifth among eligible players in his second year on the ballot. Carlos Beltran and Andrew Jones were selected as the 2025 Hall of Fame class, but this bodes very well for the chances of Felix making it down the line.
Put Felix in the hall, you cowards.
I mean, they're probably going to. He's way ahead of where Edgar was at this stage, behind where Ichiro was at this stage, but, you know, much to your dismay.
Not even
taking the bait. Wow. Okay. No. All right. Let's preview this Seahawks Rams game, starting with the unfortunate news from the Seahawks perspective, which is that Zach Charbonnet suffered an ACL tear against the Niners. When we recorded on Saturday night, there was sort of optimism that he avoided structural damage. Alas, it is instead, you know, the most significant single structural damage you can probably have. Obviously, out the rest of the playoffs, likely much of the 2026 regular season. The Seahawks do hope to get back George Helani, who was designated for return, practice fully on Tuesday.
I love George Helani.
Told reporters he's been healthy for a period of time here, but just hasn't, you know, there hasn't been the roster spot for him. So, you know, he'll likely be activated with Charbonnet going on IR. And there's going to be a heavy dose of Ken Walker III, which is something that has been a very good thing for the Seahawks in recent weeks.
Has George Helani not gotten a carry all season?
No, he definitely got carries.
This is just postseason stats, I see. I was like, that doesn't seem right. I remember him getting carries. Only 3.3 yards per carry.
No, it was much more productive in the preseason than he was during the regular season.
Well, I remember George Helani being great. So.
The sample size is not very large. It's primarily the New Orleans game where he had 10 carries for 27 yards.
And a cool 2.7 clip. That was garbage time.
That was the game that Sharps missed. And Kenneth Walker in that game went 16 for 38. So, again, running backs do not matter as much as offensive line. And the Seahawks offensive line is clicking in a strong way in the run game at this point of the season.
Yep. I mean, the Sharp news, it's sad to lose him for this game. I don't think it's not going to affect the line. It doesn't affect my perception of this game necessarily at all.
Yeah. I mean, you'd like to have him as an option. He's done terrifically in short yardage. And I like the combination of him and Ken Walker the third, what they're bringing right now. But yes, this is not the game changing injury is potentially a left tackle where none of the Seahawks options practiced on Tuesday, because now Amari Kite, who played so well late in that game on Saturday after coming in for Charles Cross, is dealing with a knee injury. Mike McDonald expressed optimism after practice on I guess this was Thursday or before practice on Thursday, whenever it was he was available to media, said that, you know, they're hopeful that Cross is going to be available, that he's doing good. But all the more important if you're down to Mason Richmond is your option behind him at tackle. On the other side, the Rams don't really have a lot of new injuries coming out of the Bears game. They had some players, you know, sort of limited or resting in practice this week, but they are as healthy as they have been.
It didn't seem like Devontae Adams was healthy in that game, what it's worth.
Do we want to talk about, this is later in my notes, but Devontae Adams, I do not think has been the same player since he came back in the playoffs after missing the end of the regular season with a hamstring injury. He has combined for 7 catches and 19 targets for 96 yards without a touchdown after his short yardage dominance during the regular season, or goal line dominance. Did have a massive catch for a first down in overtime in the Bears game. And the weather conditions, as we talked about earlier with Ben Johnson's decision, obviously a factor to that to some degree. But the Rams passing attack, whether it was, you know, Stafford's health, the Carolina defense stepping up, or, you know, the Carolina secondary being as strong as it is, I guess I should say, their boundary corners specifically, like they're easy to attack in the middle of the field. Like, the Rams have not been as prolific offensively in the playoffs as they were during the regular season as the number one offense in the NFL. So that's one of the interesting questions going into this game, I would say.
I think that's fair. I mean, we've talked so much about the Rams. Do we think that there's an element of, is it all weather, or do we think there's an element of Stafford as he's, what is he, 38 years old, 37 years old, turning 38 in a couple of weeks. And he's just played a lot of football this year. You know,
he has, for someone who, when we go through the over-under lines at some point, you will realize we were all very skeptical of Matthew Stafford's health.
I mean, there was a note in there, there was a story about Sam Darnold's coming to Seattle, and there was a note about how Matthew Stafford was given the chance to go talk to other teams over the offseason and had talked to the Raiders during that time period. And it was like, the perception of players can change very quickly, I guess.
That was Brady Henderson's great story on how Geno Smith went to Las Vegas and the Seahawks ended up with Sam Darnold as his replacement. And yes, the Stafford piece factored into it because Stafford was the Raiders' first choice last offseason. So to go back to the John Schneider thing, like, look, a lot of stuff has to line up and it's not always in your control. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that, like, Stafford wasn't potentially going to leave the Rams because they thought he wasn't good necessarily. Like, they were trying to figure out the contract piece of it.
And injuries were a concern, right? And again, this is a 37-year-old quarterback who, like, he has not been good the last 2 weeks.
He's thrown 40-plus passes each of the last 3 weeks after throwing 49 in the overtime game in Seattle. A lot of passes.
And he wasn't bad at the end of the season. I mean, there was kind of the stinker at Atlanta, but then sandwiched between the Seahawks game and the Cardinals game, which he did quite good in.
Right.
I mean, the Cardinals game was about as fair weather as you could possibly be. For one, in a game, you know, week 18, the Cardinals didn't care. It mattered to the Rams, etc. But, like, 3 of his last 4 performances have not been particularly strong. And to me, I think that's kind of why, you know, people have talked about the Rams just seem different than they did the last time they came here. And even at that point, you know, they were still a couple weeks removed from, I guess it was a little while removed from the Carolina game that they lost. But then there was that dominant stretch, you know, that he had. I mean, they were pretty much on it when they came here the last time, right? His QBR was 86, 74, 89, those 3. And then there's that Carolina loss in between. But, like, we've now had a little bit worse of a stretch. The reason that people feel differently about the Rams in some capacity is Stafford, but I think it's also been the defense too. And
well, that's interesting because the defense was sliding late in the regular season. But if the offense hasn't been that good and they've won both of these games in the playoffs, well, part of the reason is the defense has stepped up where they've only allowed, let's see. I mean, they held.
That's in the Chicago game.
But in the Carolina game as well, they're allowing 5.2 yards per play overall in the playoffs, down from 6.6 over the last 6 weeks of the regular season.
I mean, the Bears in that one, yards per play was better by like, a margin that's about the same as the margin you cited earlier from the Patriots and the Texans, right? Granted, the Bears were at home, but like, I think it's both sides of the ball. The Rams are not as dominant of a team. You even talked about the Patriots being up to number two in weighted DVOA. I'm assuming the Seahawks are number one. It's not the Rams.
Yes, it is safe to assume that the Seahawks are now number five all time in overall DVOA, including regular season and playoffs combined. It is the Rams who are down to number three in weighted DVOA.
So this is not, again, when they came to town last time, it was two of the best teams of all time playing each other. It still is two of the best teams of all time playing each other. But when you factor in the playoffs, the Seahawks moved up and the Rams have moved down.
And will be, according to DVOA, the greatest matchup on record.
Hello!
Like the highest combined DVOA on record.
On record.
So, yeah. I mean, these are two heavyweight teams, but there's some of those situations where both teams did have a higher rating than the Rams have right now.
And one of the other ones were just like slightly worse than the Seahawks are.
Exactly. They were more balanced, somewhat more balanced matchups.
The Seahawks are the ones who are punching their weight. So I guess, I don't know. I mean, we could break this down offensively, defensively. It's a little tough to look at because, again, we've talked so much about the Rams and they had two games defensively, the Seahawks against them. One of them was maybe one of the worst defensive performances overall in franchise history, or at least it was yards wise, the worst performance overall in franchise history. The other one was one of the worst games that Matt Stafford has ever played as a Ram. So if you're just going to look at one and not look at the other, I don't think that makes sense. I think the obvious point is kind of to assume it's somewhere in between, right, for Matt Stafford. And even the way that he's played these last couple of weeks, I would probably be a little bit more skeptical about Stafford being closer to that worst performance than he has been to the best performance, right? It's a pretty rested Seattle defense, not dealing with a lot of injuries defensively. And you kind of saw what they did to the Niners last week. Granted, Mike McDonald has been dominant against the Niners overall, but I'm not like fully convinced that there's just some coaches who can't coach against some defenses and vice versa. Like I think Mike McDonald is aware of what the Rams are trying to do.
But do you think that Kyle Shanahan can't scheme against Mike McDonald's defense?
No, I think the defense is really fucking good.
I suppose.
More than Kyle Shanahan can't scheme against them. I mean, he schemed not terribly against them in week one. It's just the defense is not the same defense as it was in week one.
And to reverse my position entirely, this actually is because of the Rams being so good that this is the greatest matchup in the 47 years of DVOA.
Oh, really?
Because
okay.
Both of these teams, Seattle's at 41, Rams are at 40%. It's only the seventh other time playoff. This is playoffs only. Seventh other time that both teams have been over 30%. So, the way I broke this down, I wanted to break this down is like, if you look at the six different units in this game and rank them, number one unit by DVOA, Seahawks offense at 36% better than league average. Number two,
I'm sorry, the number one unit was the Seahawks offense?
Sorry, Seahawks defense.
Okay. I was like, I'm going to have to call
you
the
need
police.
A moment?
I was like, I was like, there might be glitches in the computer. The offense is bad, but like,
the glitches
Seahawks
were
defense.
in the person reading his own notes here, unfortunately.
Seahawks defense is the number one unit.
Seahawks defense number one, 36% better than league average.
Give me number two. Can I do it?
Sure.
What's not the Family Feud style?
Sure.
Number two is Seahawks special teams. Give me Seahawks special teams on the board. is it Rams offense then?
Yes.
Okay.
Obviously, it's Rams offense. They're at 28%. Special teams, you can't get that much deviation from average.
Okay, and then it goes Seahawks offense. Rams defense? Rams defense? Seahawks special teams?
There you are.
I had it right the first. You were like, well, I was swayed because you were like, you can't.
Because the Rams offense is 28% better than league average. The Seahawks special teams is 11% better than league average, which is one of the best of all time. You know, it's up there, but... Not nearly
then
as
do
high.
We have Seahawks offense.
You are
Rams
really bad at this game.
Rams defense.
Rams defense.
Then
is
Seahawks
four.
Offense. But it's kind of like how do you weigh these chunks, right? Because special teams
you didn't guess what was sixth.
Rams special teams.
Yes.
Six by a
the
mile.
only unit where the coordinator got fired during the season.
I mean, it does matter.
They are
right?
only
Like,
minus 3%. They are not as bad on special teams in this regard as the Seahawks are good.
But the Seahawks are very good at special teams. It's also one of those things where teams can get so consumed by thinking about something where, like, I don't know if this hurt the Rams in Chicago, but the Rams spent a lot of time thinking about the cold, and they didn't play very good in the game, right? Like, they won the game, but I wouldn't say that the Rams, like, played a great game. They went into what is the Bears are like number 16 in DVOA. Good fucking job, you know?
Wow, Jimmer in
shambles.
No,
this
is
is
serious.
I love the Bears. This is not a critique of the Bears. That just means there's room to improve for the Bears. But if
yes, I agree.
Statistically, we know that the Bears are not one of the best teams in the league.
I mean, one of the big thoughts I had on Sunday is like, hey, you remember when people were talking about like how it might not be that much of an advantage to be the number one seed because of the path you'd face? Like,
you were people. What do you mean, people?
No,
I
was
was the one here
pointing that it
being
was
like,
definitive.
No. Okay, well, you were wrong. I was the one being like, are you stupid? Get the number one seed.
You
And you were like,
do not want to play. No, the argument was never don't get the number one seed.
Let me also just throw this out there to you. None of this shit would have mattered.
Seahawks would have won anyway in the cold.
They would have beaten any of these teams. Do you think that Seahawks defense wouldn't have been able to travel to Chicago in the cold and win that game?
I think they probably would have done quite well.
Give me any team in the NFC or the AFC in any place in the face of the earth, and the Seahawks team is going to beat them.
I think a way that people are thinking about this game to some degree, particularly people who are high on the Rams' chances, and this was me before the last meeting, is that the Rams defense is better than the Seahawks offense, and the Seahawks defense is better than the Rams offense. Like that, those sort of cancel each other out. But I think maybe a more interesting way to think about it is like the gaps there. Like the Seahawks defense in DVOA has a greater advantage over the Rams offense than the Rams defense does over the Seahawks offense. And if you rank it the 1 to 6, like we did, it's Seahawks 1-3-5, Rams 2-4-6. So both at their strength,
yep,
at their middle, and their weakness, in each of those, the Seahawks have an advantage.
Yeah. But also, like, as I know that the trend lines, you have to view it as the whole season in general, right? You can't just be like, where these teams are playing right now. The trend is down for the Rams.
I don't think it's as down as you think it is. So this is something else I looked at. If we go back to since the first meeting, the Rams in that span are number one offensively in EPA per play. The Seahawks offense has trended down to 12th, although fourth in rushing, which is going to be pretty crucial in this game, the Rams being one of the teams ahead of them. The Seahawks are obviously number one in EPA allowed per play, not by a mile, because Minnesota's defense was pretty mean down the stretch. The Rams are 15th in that span. So I don't think, like, the Rams are not as balanced, but similar, this neither are the Seahawks. Similar to how the Seahawks defense has gotten better enough since that first meeting to offset the offense coming back to the mean, the Rams offense has also gotten better since that first meeting.
Is that true? The Rams offense has gotten better?
I mean, I don't
since
know
that
about
first meeting? Or is it just basically like they had a few dominant victories in between there, right? They had the Arizona game.
The
where
Tampa
they crushed
game. Yeah, I mean, like, it depends where you set the endpoints to a degree, certainly.
Because I'm not sure if I'm seeing that, right? They've scored a lot of points in all these games, I guess is what I'll say, aside from the Chicago one.
Well, part of the reason is I'm taking it after that game. And if you include that game, the Rams offense was not as good because the Rams offense had their worst game of the season against the Seahawks.
I guess I'm curious where you set that point at, because
the Rams were
I do
sixth in EPA per play after facing the Seahawks. If you say before facing the Seahawks, they were
six
let's
in
see
the
here.
league in EPA per play?
Third. They were third going into the Seahawks game in EPA
which,
per play.
Which Seahawks game? The second one?
The first one.
They were third going into that game, and
yes,
they were sixth after it.
Yes. And then
because that includes the Seahawks game?
Right.
Okay.
So if you take out the Tampa Bay game and say since the Tampa Bay game, which is where they sort of looked the strongest. They are third in EPA per play, but now it's like percentage fractionally behind Buffalo and New England.
Interesting.
So I
That's
don't
kind of
think their
fascinating.
offense is getting, I do think their offense
You think the
is it.
weather was purely the factor last week?
I don't know if I want to say it's purely the factor. I don't know where Stafford's hand is at in all of those things,
Because, I mean,
but
we saw that in Carolina, right? He hurt his hand, and the four sacks for 29 yards, the 4.4 yards per play. I just look at this team and I think to myself, and people going into it were basically like, oh, Kyron Williams can win on his own. And I was like, I just don't know if I buy that. And that's not what happened. Kyron Williams didn't win it on his own. You know, it kind of took, I mean, I guess we give the Rams defense credit, but it took three picks from Caleb Williams. And that's kind of the difference in the game. Like, there's a lot of avenues that we see the Bears in Seattle if those things don't happen. Puka Nacua was not as good in that
Well,
one. Maybe
so
it's
that's
the weather.
interesting. So since torching the Seahawks for 12 catches, 16 targets, 225 yards, two touchdowns, they've played four games since then, the two at the end of the regular season without Adams, the two in the playoffs with him. He's averaging just 9.7 yards per reception in that, down from 14 beforehand, and has had three very low catch rates out of those four games. He's at 54% catch rate so far in the playoffs. So I don't know if there's something for the Seahawks to learn from there in the, you know, what opponents are doing to make life more difficult for Puka Nacua, since he, I was going to say dance through their secondary, but that would be an extremely poor choice of words in this particular case. So I will avoid it.
Yeah, I think you're right about Puka. I mean, that Falcons game was dreadful, right? Five catches on 10 targets for 47 yards and a long of 11. Obviously, the Seahawks game is, I don't want to say it's the outlier. There's that stretch, though, the 167, 181, 225, where Puka was playing at a pretty different level, and he hasn't been there.
And what it
And
is certainly, if it's not an outlier, is a high point. And he did have 111 yards against the Panthers in the first round of the playoffs, but it took 18 targets, more than he had in the 225-yard game against the Seahawks or in any other game this season.
do we think that could be Devontae Adams related, though? I mean, it would
I
be
do,
almost
yeah.
impossible to, I guess, say that it's not Devontae Adams related.
I mean, certainly if you go back to like Nacua, the jump that he has taken from 2024 to 2025, I mean, some of that is probably health coming into his own, you know, in what should be the prime of his career. But I do think having Devontae Adams there, despite the fact that, again, Cooper Kupp, number one Seahawks playoff receiver, you know, I do think that's been an upgrade.
And I guess on the flip side, you could look at JSN, right? The yardage hasn't been as strong as it was through the middle of the season, right? When you talk about that high point, like his high point was probably, you know, weeks, whatever, five through like 10 or something like that. But the efficiency has still been there for JSN.
Exactly. It's more about the level of targets that he's getting because of the defensive attention that he's drawing, because of the Seahawks going away from throwing the ball a lot.
And in that time period, running the ball fairly well.
Yes.
So it's kind of a different offense that the Seahawks are running now, even maybe than they were. I mean, I guess Ken Walker ran the ball pretty damn well in the game against the Rams, but like they were in the process of sort of running a slightly different offense, probably closer to the type of offense that they thought they were going to run coming into the season.
Yes.
So I guess the way that I was thinking about it was, and we talked about those other games earlier, is how many different like paths to victory do you have in a game? And you know, like if you're the better team, right, you have a lot of different paths to victory. And if you're like the Seahawks in this one against the Rams, I was kind of thinking about it is they, and we've seen this two different times, they had almost two different paths to victory, which were they didn't play very good in at the very least the game at LA and then for three quarters of the game in Seattle. And they still managed to find themselves winning because the thing is, the special teams do matter, right? That helps your different avenues to victory in these games. I think the Rams need to play not a near perfect game, but the Rams have to play a much better game than the Seahawks have to play to win this one.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, they're certainly more than capable of doing it. You know, there's a reason that these teams are, again, as close as they are in terms of overall DVOA, and a reason that, you know, the spread is as close as it is, like even above and beyond just Sam Darnold in the big game, which Like the beauty of the, oh, player at or coach X struggles in big games is, well, you get to define a big game based on whatever the most recent game or the next game is. So the fact that, Sam Darnold performed more than well enough for the Seahawks to win against the Niners while dealing with an oblique injury, like it just doesn't even get to count after until tomorrow's Sunday's game happens tomorrow. I don't know.
I mean, did he also not was at San Francisco on that Saturday night to be
Right.
the number one seed in the NFC? Was that not a big game? Because that one he was 20 of 26 for 200 yards.
It's funny because it was the exact same scenario, number one seed on the line against division rival in week 18, that did count as a big game because he didn't play well for the Vikings in 2024, but because he did play well for the Seahawks in 2025, now therefore it doesn't count because there are bigger games ahead.
There is an element of turnovers. There's an element of randomness, right? And, or maybe a high degree of randomness. The fact that he's had the six turnovers against the Rams is it six? Or was there a fumble in there too? It's not necessarily a coincidence,
Right.
but it's not something that I would expect to repeat itself. And it may happen again also. And I don't even think that necessarily makes it a trend, right? Like, the whole thing is such small sample size. Like, I don't really buy that the Rams are playing a type of defense that is going to make Sam Darnold turnover prone or that they're doing anything there. Like, if anything, my expectation is that the turnover differential would probably even out in this one. And your expectation would be that it should favor the Seahawks because the Seahawks have better turnover differential throughout the season than the Rams.
I don't think so. No, the Seahawks turnover differential is pretty horrible generally because
I
Sam
guess
Darnold has been quite turnover prone.
Because of those, but the types of turnovers that the offense or that the defense can generate, like I wouldn't expect that not to happen. Probably be closer then. I just it's hard to take either of the previous matchups and necessarily take anything from them because they were two totally different games that these two teams played, and the games that they've played in the interim have been pretty radically different also. And I think you just have to come down to who's the better team, and the Seahawks are the better team. They're playing this game at home. And they've been playing quite well. Charles Cross is going to be a huge factor in this one, right? Like whether Charles Cross is playing or not is going to be a big deal, and who's playing left tackle is going to be a big deal in it. But the kind of Devontae Adams that we see, like I think the Seahawks defense is very, very aware of the performance that the Rams had against them the last time. And I don't think it's the kind of thing that's going to happen again.
The Rams are plus 10 on the season, or during the regular season, were plus 10 in terms of turnover differential. The Seahawks were minus 3. So, yeah, I mean, I like look, turnovers will likely favor the Rams in this game. Yards per play will likely favor the Seahawks. Special teams will likely favor the Seahawks. Like, you put those all into a blend, I think it favors the Seahawks, but not overwhelmingly, that's for sure.
I mean, I think there's two ways this game happens. It's either a close game, right? It's a 3-point game, or the Seahawks win it by 25.
I don't see the Seahawks winning it by 25. I could see the Seahawks winning it comfortably, but actually, I mean, maybe I can't because one of the lessons that we've learned in this is in these two games is like the most dangerous place to be for these two teams is having a lead and taking your foot off the gas too early. You don't agree with that? Because
I
the
The
like
lesson that lesson happened to the Rams two times.
I
It
agree with
never
that.
happened. It never happened to the Seahawks. The
But
Seahawks.
I don't want the Seahawks to be in a position where Matthew Stafford is passing a lot more.
What you're telling me is the Rams team over time, the Seahawks are better. Even if they've had a lead, the Seahawks are going to grind away because they're the better team. That we didn't learn any lesson from it. We learned that over time, the Seahawks are a better team. If you play enough quarters, they're gonna fucking win.
I don't know that I agree with that necessarily. I mean, I do think
But
they're the better
everybody
team.
is telling you that, right? The DVOA is telling you that. I don't need to tell you that. The
I agree
number
that
one
they're the better
seed
team.
is
I
telling
don't
you that.
think it's inevitable that, like, just because the Seahawks are going, that's a little bit too much gambler's fallacy for me. Yes, they are likely in any given quarter to have a slight advantage, but it was exacerbated by the fact that the Rams got too one-dimensional in the second half of both of those games. And maybe Sean McVay will learn from that lesson, and it won't be such an issue. But I'd rather have the Rams in position where they're trying to run against the Seahawks than trying to pass against the Seahawks. That's my position. Because as good as this Rams team is in the run game, the Seahawks defense is so good against the run that I don't think you want that. And it's not a situation like last week where, you know, Brock Purdy was not capable in this that Niners passing offense was not capable of coming back from once the deficit got to a certain point. I do think the Rams offense is.
Once the deficit got to seven, then it was over. I think
you can't say that and argue turnover luck when there was some turnover luck in the Seahawks' favor in that game. It wasn't 34 points worth, or 35 points worth, but there was some.
I think you're wrong about this, though. Matt Stafford threw 20 incomplete passes in that game that they scored. Like,
that's fair. He did throw again 48 total passes.
He threw 49 passes. So this idea that they're like taking their foot off the gas, I don't think that's what the Rams would tell you they were doing.
I think that what percentage of those passes I would want to know were, you know, third and long situations, or, you know, it wasn't a lot of favorable play action against loaded up boxes.
I mean, when they were up by two touchdowns, or they scored a touchdown on this drive. In fact, this was to put them up two touchdowns. Run, pass, run, 58-yard pass. Was that in overtime? No, that's in the fourth quarter. 58-yard pass, run, 1-yard touchdown pass to Puka. Like, I mean, yes, on the like three and out that they had where they were up 30-22, it was two runs and then an incompletion. Or that they were up 30-14 when they did that. The Seahawks touchdown made it 30-22 on that. Like, sure. But then the next one, it was pass, incompletion. So I just don't, literally that was three in a row passes at a 32-22 game. And then the next one was run, incompletion, 5-yard pass, punt. So I'm not sure that I buy that at all, that they were taking their foot off the gas. The defense is better. That is what has happened in these games. Yes, the Rams have gotten a little bit of a lead. Like, even in the overtime, right? Like, they were moving the ball a little bit. It still required a 41-yard touchdown pass. And if your expectation is that you're going to have a 58-yard pass and a 41-yard touchdown pass, be my guest. If you are going to go in this game and think that the Rams are going to have those kind of big plays again, I dare you to have confidence in that.
I would also dare you to have confidence in the Seahawks having a 46-yard screen pass, what was the big Walker run in this one? I don't know. You know, they had some big plays of their own. But yeah, I agree that, like,
They don't need to have those types of plays, though, necessarily. The Rams need those plays more than the Seahawks do.
Probably. I had a 55-yard touchdown. They probably need those more plays somewhat more. What's fascinating about it is it's just like so different from the Seahawks defense we've seen at any other point since the Tampa Bay game. Essentially, that Rams game is so
but
an outlier.
The Tampa Bay game. The Tampa Bay game is the secondary was down to
I had forgotten until Mike Sean Jagar wrote about that game in his piece on Thursday that DeMarcus Lawrence was also out for that one, which
I didn't even realize.
Yeah, because we probably didn't realize at the time what a big loss it was based on the production that he's had the rest of the season after coming back from that. But it has been noted that the Seahawks have not given up a play longer than 20 yards since the Rams game, since the Puka Nacquia touchdown, I guess. So they've gone three consecutive games without it, which there's only a handful of teams. I can't remember where that post was on social, but it's only happened a few times in NFL history.
So when Oregon beat James Madison, he has a friend whose dad went to Oregon. Luca has a friend whose dad went to Oregon and was talking shit on text. And I was like, Luca, here's what you text back. Get your hopes up. And that is what I would text to any Rams fan who is thinking to themselves, we're going to dominate the turnovers. We're going to have these big plays again against this team. I would say in this game to Rams fans, get your hopes up.
It was a Doug Clawson of CBS Sports who had that stat. The only team since 2000 to not allow a play of more than 20 yards in three straight games, including the playoffs. I mean, obviously, how many three-game stretches, including the playoffs, is a lot lower. I mean, you certainly think the Rams' chances of winning this game are better than Oregon's chances against Indiana, right? I mean, you have to think that. What was the line in Oregon?
I think that
Indiana?
Was like seven. I actually think the teams are.
No, I guess it was.
I think the teams are shockingly similar.
I am seeing 3 to 3.5 points.
I think that Indiana offense, like, obviously this comparatively is better than, but I think the Seahawks defense is better. I think both these teams are juggernauts, and they're just the types of teams that, like, it's inevitable, right? You could go in every game, you can worry about it. They might play a close game at some point, but like the Seahawks, this Seahawks 2025 team is an inevitability. And it is, they are such a hard team to beat because of that, because the defense is not just, it's not the Texans defense, right? Like, people raving about that. They are better. They're better than any defense across the league. And the team is one of the best teams of all time. They're an efficient offensive team who's running the ball well now. They let us start running the ball.
I mean, they're not an efficient passing team anymore. Let's be clear about that.
I don't know if I buy that.
Do you want to know where the Seahawks are in pass DVOA in that span?
I guess it depends on your definition of efficient, but like the...
Having an IP high EPA per play, I think, would be a good measure of efficiency. I mean, certainly if you include the Rams game, you know, their passing offense has not been very good for a long period of time now, but I think especially... I mean,
Darnold has been like a little bit more conservative, but we're talking about like a 77% completion percentage, no turnovers against the Niners to end the season, and then a 70% no turnovers. Like, these... I'm not having to do that much.
I'm including the first Rams game for maximum making you look wrong potential.
Okay, sure.
Where do you think the Seahawks are in EPA per play on dropbacks, including that game?
I don't know. 20th? Is that what you're going to say?
19th. Number 20 is the Arizona Cardinals. They're behind the New Orleans Saints.
Oh, so you can't compare anybody to Tyler Shook. Come on.
Okay, they're behind the Washington Commanders. They're behind the Houston Texans. They're behind the New York Giants. They're behind the San Francisco 49ers. I've heard many slanderous things about that passing attack lately.
I do think this is including the first Rams game.
Yes.
I do think that they've changed the offense a little bit to represent how good the defense has been. It's a dangerous territory. And granted, if the Seahawks are going to lose a game, the way that they are going to lose a game is by thinking they don't need, is by making a mistake.
Right.
I mean, an unforced error, not in terms of a turnover or something like that. It's going to be kicking a field goal when they should have gone for it.
Yeah.
It's going to be thinking, I will always be skeptical about defensive coaches, right? And I do think that the one way they can lose one of these games is...
The one way?
Right.
What do you think the win percentage chances of victory? I know that's usually the last part of this conversation, but what do you think it is?
I don't know, 70%.
You should go to the casino then.
I literally was looking at a parlay, like a Seahawks victory and Patriots victory parlay. Pretty good numbers on that. But and then with the Seahawks Super Bowl as well. But like, they've changed the way that they've played a little bit, right? They've slowed it down. They're running a little bit more. They're trying to get Sam Darnold to throw more efficient passes. It's probably the right thing to do overall. They haven't been pushed into a game yet.
It's true. It'll be interesting to see what happens when they are.
The time that they were was against the Rams, and was Darnold not great in that fourth quarter and overtime? When they needed Sam Darnold, was he not great?
He was.
So I just, like, I look at the...
The Rams are really good, man. We just established that they have a...
I don't buy
very
it.
Similar overall
I
DVOA.
Don't buy it on the Rams.
You don't buy the team that has been good for a long period of time. You're more skeptical of that than the team that came out of nowhere this year. That's your position.
I'm looking at the team that beat the Panthers by 3 and the Bears by 3.
You just started this conversation with you shouldn't pay as much attention to trend line as the overall.
I know, but I'm just saying that. It's not true. I don't believe it. That's for you. I watched both those games and I was like, this team just isn't that good.
I do think the Seahawks are the better team. They have home field advantage. They have an extra day of rest. So this is not the 50-50 game that I thought that the last matchup between these two teams was. I have it at 60% Seahawks, which is higher, I think, than the implied odds, but lower than what DVOA would tell you.
What would DVOA tell you?
65.
I've been close to in line with DVOA. You're below DVOA?
Yeah. I mean, DVOA is very good, but it's not perfect. And DVOA has pretty consistently been higher on the Seattle Seahawks in 2025 than any other team. And 2026.
But they never lose. Like, what? It's not that they've been higher. Like, who beat the Rams? Lost to the Falcons. Like, what?
That's a better loss than losing to the Buccaneers at this point, right?
No, not the where the Buccaneers were at the time.
I suppose. Part of the reason they were where they were at the time is because they beat the Seahawks. And then they were in a different place, in part because they lost so badly to the Rams.
I don't. I mean, the Bucs had just beaten Houston. Like, they beat at the Falcons, which was too difficult of a game for the Rams. Like, I don't know, it was early in the season. And when also you talk about, they went and beat the Niners the next week. It was a better Buccaneers team at that point than it was. And beyond that, they lost week one, where they hadn't quite figured out the team yet. And it was a close game in week one. And then they lost a game at the Rams. And they missed a field goal to win the game. Like, good teams at this level don't lose to teams like the Panthers. And they don't lose to teams like the Falcons. Like,
but they do lose to teams like the Rams.
How could you say that DVOA is overrating the Seahawks when there's nothing that has shown us? They won a playoff game by 35 points last week. The team that just beat the Eagles,
other metrics
by 35.
Include these games too.
What other
part
metrics?
Of what they include? You don't think there's any other advanced metrics for football?
No, I mean, which ones are more down on the Seahawks?
Well, the FPI win probability is 55%.
Oh,
again, I think that's too low, but I'm exactly in the middle. That wasn't intentional, but of FPI and DVOA on this one.
Get your hopes up.
You get your hopes up.
I feel comfortable getting my hopes up. My hopes are so far up that I'm not concerned at all. Luca's like, I keep thinking about this game, and I'm like, I've thought about it once. I'll be there on Sunday. It'll be loud. It'll be great. The only thing I'm thinking about is how we're going to celebrate after.
Oh, Jesus. Why are you the way you are?
I'm speaking so genuinely about how I feel.
No one's disputing that this is an old takes Tristan thing. That's not the issue here.
You were quivering when you saw this fucking Rams team who couldn't move the ball against the Bears.
No, I was quivering when I saw Puka Nacua have 225 yards on the Seahawks secondary like
lucky.
4 weeks ago.
It's lucky. Do it again.
Well, we'll make for an interesting postgame pod on Sunday. I'm sure of that. All right.
It is funny. Like, obviously we've done post NFC Championship podcast twice. The first one of those, probably Chris was texting me about, like, maybe our most legendary podcast of all time, recorded on your phone in your car with a bottle of champagne. I just, like, kind of nothing can compare to, obviously, the Seahawks had gone to the Super Bowl in 2005. We were like prime age for that. I remember that one just being like, yeah, they beat the Panthers. Like, we were excited about it, but it didn't feel like the magnitude.
Well, partially because what was our quarrel with Steve Smith Sr.? We love Steve Smith Sr. We don't have any negative feelings about version of the Panthers.
And that's why this is right. Like, the way that the season has been set up, and that's what we would have felt if they were playing the Bears, where I'm like, I don't want to beat the Bears.
I mean, I would still want to beat the Bears, but yes, there wouldn't be the same stakes. And it's one of the things I didn't get a chance to look up. I'm curious how many teams have had to beat two division rivals en route to in the playoffs.
That would be a fascinating thing to see.
It can't have happened that often in NFL history.
Well, especially if you have the bye too, like that it's not.
That they've not faced anyone outside the NFC West in the NFC portion of the playoffs. And
if you were to, we could talk about this after the game, as it happens when we're doing our celebratory pod, that
it will not be recorded on a phone. I can confidently say that.
That's fine. That if you were to set up a path for the Super Bowl, this is precisely the way you would set it up. As far as you
there is the potential. Like, I don't want to look that far ahead. Let's wait until Sunday. But the other game's going to get played first. And there is the potential for, like, the all-time.
No, that's what I'm talking about. Those three teams of, literally, if you were like, I want to, who are the three teams I want to be.
The only team you'd rather have be part of the path is Oregon.
Yeah. If we can make that happen. Dante Moore saw this defense and was like, I'm good. He was like, I'm going to chill here in college for another year. Can we play the Jets next year?
I'll give them a 99% chance of victory if they face Oregon on a neutral field. I do not know what the upcoming AFC opponent is. I guess there's a 1-in-3 chance, but
we do not play the Jets next year.
What is it, the AFC North?
We play the AFC West, I think.
Oh, no Pete Carroll revenge game.
Yeah, we do play the AFC West. But Dante Moore was like, I've seen those NFL defenses. I mean, it's not just the Seahawks, right? It's the entire league. But like, he was like, yeah, I'm going to chill here for a second. I'm going to throw some more dump offs.
All right. Well, on that note, let's get into the roundup quickly here.
We will see Fernando Mendoza, though.
Oh. Wait, you're assuming he's going to be the Raiders? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm assuming he's going to be the Raiders. I think it's minus 700 for it to be Fernando Mendoza. I mean, unless they trade the pick or something. But
exactly. Mariners news, they avoided arbitration with their lone remaining eligible player, Bryce Miller, by agreeing to a one-year deal for $2.4 million after Miller filed for arbitration previously. All right, Seattle Kraken. As soon as you were selling the playoff path, they immediately went on a four-game losing streak, although they did snap that slide on Wednesday night against the Islanders, winning 4-1, still comfortably ahead of NHL 500, but they have dropped now down to fourth in the Pacific Division standings with 53 points. That would put them tied for the final playoff spot in the West. They do still have some degree of that game's advantage, having played 49 games, a lot of teams up over 50. The upcoming schedule at home against Anaheim, New Jersey over the weekend, and then the Washington Capitals next Tuesday as part of a 6-game homestand for the Kraken. All right, little Seattle Storm news. The WNBA schedule was released on Wednesday amidst the league and its players being in a status quo situation with a moratorium on transactions as they continue to negotiate the collective bargaining agreement. The Storm will host the Golden State Valkyries in the season opener on May 8th, having faced them in the regular season finale at home last year. Then they immediately head out on the road for a 3-game trip back east before coming back for a 4-game homestand. Their first matchup with the reborn Portland Fire in the renewed I-5 rivalry comes June 17th at the Moda Center. The Fire will visit on Independence Day, July 4th. Toronto Tempo's inaugural visit will happen on August 26th. That's just before the league breaks briefly for the FIBA Basketball World Cup at the start of September. The Storm will return by hosting the defending champion Las Vegas Aces for the only time on September 17th and wrap up the regular season at home the following week against the Dallas Wings and Paige Beckers. Our UW Women's Basketball, when we last recorded, we're feeling a little down about the state of UW women's basketball after two consecutive losses, but a bad loss at Purdue and getting thumped pretty good at home by Michigan State. But they have righted the ship since then. Finished that road trip with an 82-63 win Wednesday at Indiana, where they led by 11 after one quarter in Bloomington, never looked back. Elodine and Yulia Grabovskaya both shot 8 of 11 from the field, with leading scoring 19 and Grabovskaya at 16. And Bryn Magoya adding 13 off the bench as the Huskies outscored IU 54-20 in the paint. Came back home Sunday against what we described as a very difficult opponent in Minnesota and outscored the Golden Gophers by 16 points in the second and third quarters, then cruised to a 67-54 win. Sunday, Xavier Sellers led the way with 23 points on 9 of 14 shooting as the Huskies held Minnesota under 40% from the field. A little trickier than expected Wednesday against lowly Penn State, leading by just one at halftime before clamping down after the break. They allowed 28 points on 38% shooting in the second half and pulled away for a 16-point win, buying 24 points from Sellers, and another strong performance off the bench from McGoy with 14 points and 9 boards. The first two wins got the Huskies back in the rankings at number 25. They're currently a 7 seed in the latest ESPN bracketology update. So comfortably in the field as they make hey, against this week stretch of the schedule, which essentially wraps up Sunday when they start a road trip at Rutgers against the worst team in the Big Ten per Bart Torvik, albeit coming off its first conference win against aforementioned Penn State on Sunday. The Scarlet Knights have 5 losses by at least 18 points, including 47 to Maryland and 43 to Iowa, both at home, and are shooting under 40% on 2. So this should be another win for the Huskies to extend that winning streak to 4 games. All right, UW men's basketball. We were there Wednesday as they hosted number 4 Michigan, and were competitive in that one. You know, felt at times like they could really give Michigan a scare, but eventually settled for a 10-point loss against the mighty Wolverines, still number 1 in KenPom.
Yeah, it was a fun game. It was a fun game to be at. That it's like, I don't think I've been in the arena that packed since, I don't even know, like, before any of the players that you would be thinking of are on the team. Like, Brandon Roy was probably on the team the last time I was in the arena, and it was that packed.
There's no way. There had to be some of the games when we had season tickets later in the Romar era, like during the
that
IT
full?
Era.
Man, it was maybe.
I guess they've had sellouts. For me, the answer would be the Oregon game in March 2020 or February. It was like late. No, I guess I'm not seeing it. It was January 2020. It was earlier than I thought, but they lost in overtime 64-61 on a Peyton Pritchard game-winning 3. I'm pretty sure it was packed for that one.
I don't remember it, but that sounds terrible. I'm so mad about it. you were at that game that they beat Arizona, right?
Yes.
Dominic Green hit that shot to beat Arizona.
Oh, I guess it must have been full at that one, too.
I assume that one was pretty packed.
That was Hop's first year, so that was the year before.
Maybe that was the last time we were going nuts. That was like the last time that I really remember like deeply, deeply caring about the team. But I mean, obviously there were a lot of Michigan fans in the building. It wasn't just like the excitement around Husky basketball, but it is one of the fun things of being in the Big Ten, which is like, you're going to play Michigan. You know what I mean? Like, it's fun to play teams that are the best teams across the country. And it happened here. Like, Arizona had some very, very good seasons. There were teams that they played in the Pac-12 who were good. Not really anything like having a weekend of playing Michigan and Michigan State.
Yeah. I mean, they're down 2 top 10 teams by KenPom, plus kind of the massive, you know, history with both of these teams, particularly Michigan State. But in that game, the difference really, I think, ultimately, it was nice, first of all, to see the Huskies briefly get healthy for a period of time. Jacob Ignacevich made his season debut coming back from a foot fracture. His Husky debut, made a pair of threes and scored 10 points off the bench. So that was nice.
I like Ignacevich a lot. Yeah.
That was the strongest of the 3 games he's played thus far.
Wasn't bad last night. There was some good stuff against Nebraska.
Okay. Wesley Yates III returned from his wrist surgery, so that was exciting to see. But it was Michigan's size of UCLA, because I'm thinking of Adai Mara, who transferred from there. Mara had 20 points in 23 minutes on 10 of 11 shooting, plus 3 blocks. Then they had 18-16 from power forward Merez Johnson Jr., and that was just impossible for the Huskies to deal with.
Absolutely dominant. And even Kepnong, you know, Kepnong's big, but he's not that big. They're very good at getting him into space to make buckets. Like, that is a thing that Michigan is exceedingly good at, is utilizing Mara. Like, it's not as hard as it, you know, when you have his size, but like, they're good at putting him into good positions.
Which I think is like, this is Dusty May's thing, kind of. He had a 7-footer that came with him to Michigan when he was at Florida Atlantic. Last year, they started 2 essentially 7-footers. Because they also brought in Danny Wolfe as a transfer,
like a fetish
who ended up
at this
being
point.
Drafted in the first round. Well, it's not Purdue level. and then, you know, Mara with his size. And they don't shoot it great for sure, but, you know, the playmaking of Elliot Cadeau and just enough shooting to create space for Mara and Johnson to operate inside. So it was a fun game to play against a team that good. The Huskies acquitted themselves fairly well. I don't think they acquitted themselves as well on Saturday against Michigan State. I assume you saw none of this game because you were headed to the Seahawks game immediately afterwards. Huskies shot 64% on 2s, still got blown out by Michigan State thanks to forcing just 5 turnovers and shooting 3 of 19 on 3s. Zoom Diallo and Hannes Steinbach combined for 35 points, but Frank Kepnong was the only other Husky with more than 5. And Spartans point guard Jeremy Fears picked the Husky defense apart with 19 points on 6 of 9 shooting, 5 assists, and 3 steals. He just kept getting into the lane out of pick and roll, out will, and the Huskies really had no answer in that loss. So Wednesday, this gauntlet, this was actually the easiest of the teams the Huskies played in terms of KenPom, at Nebraska, where again competitive in a 76-66 loss, but the Cornhuskers improved to 19-0. And really the same bright spots. Hanna Steinbach at 21-12, 18 points on 8 of 14 shooting from Zoom Diallo, but Kimari Peterson and Bryson Tucker shot a combined 1 of 14 from the field, and Bryce Sanford scored 23 to lead Nebraska offense that shot 51% overall and 38% on threes.
Just a frustrating team. You get a little bit of a run going, and then it's just bang a three. And it's a difficult team to play against, Nebraska.
They remind me of a lot of like Iowa teams of fairly recent vintage,
Me too.
possibly because
I
Sanford transferred from
wonder
Iowa
why.
and his brother played there many years. Yes, there's some other commonalities between those two rosters. But yeah, I mean, a really good team. We didn't get a chance to preview that one, so we didn't break down Nebraska the way I kind of hoped, but a legitimate team.
I think my takeaway from all three of these games is, I mean, Hannes is a, I wish that players played more than 1 year in college. And I think Hannes is going to get to the NBA, and I am very skeptical about him in some ways because he's not a good enough shooter to just be at like 17 feet. He doesn't really stretch the floor. He needs to be able to draw fouls in the paint. And that was my takeaway against Michigan. It was my same takeaway against Nebraska. There was one play where he went to the hoop where they were like, thought that should have been a foul. And I'm like, forgetting about. I do actually think the refs favored UW in that Nebraska game in some ways, where there were some calls where I was like, I don't know what they saw there. But like, you, if you're going to do what Hannes Steinbach does, you have to be able to get to the line more efficiently than he does in those games and pick up fouls against those types of players. And he doesn't do it right now. And I think it's a pretty huge gap in his game. And then also the 3-point shooting, like Kamari Peterson, when he's on, the team plays much better. When he's not, it is bleak.
He is a bellwether in many ways. I mean, Hannes had a pair of threes against Nebraska. I do think he's eventually going to be a 3-point shooter in the NBA, but it is definitely a fair point that, like
It's not saying that
seeking out.
he'll never get there, but I'm just like, it's a hard way to play college basketball. What he's
Agreed.
doing, if you can't draw fouls consistently. And it might even just be like down to selling it more or something like that,
Right.
but
Which is a skill.
yeah.
So between the two home games, Desmond Claude announced that he is withdrawing from on-court activities. Claude posted on X that the ankle injury he suffered during the preseason was a grade 3 injury, the most severe possible type of sprain, carried a 12-week timeline, but in conjunction with the UW staff, he decided to return in 5, said he'd subsequently been playing through, quote, unbearable pain and suffered an additional knee injury. So Claude had kind of, Danny Sprinkle had explained it as him being away from the team for personal reasons when he did not play against Ohio State, played just 8 minutes in the Michigan
It's such a
game.
strange one. Yeah, because he was on the bench where I'm like, what is the benefit here? But I mean, maybe it's just how Desmond wanted it to be framed, you know?
So, Huskies will be back home Sunday for a reprieve from the brutal schedule, hosting a struggling Oregon team that hasn't won since January 2nd, and currently would be their worst KenPom finish since Dana Altman's first season in Eugene. The Ducks are 1-7 overall in Big Ten play, have played many of the same top teams as UW, but also lost in overtime at lowly Rutgers, and don't have a single win this season over a team ranked higher than 100 in KenPom. Injuries are definitely a factor now. Point guard Jackson Schjelstad is out for the season due to a hand injury, and senior center Nate Biddle, very experienced, expected to miss at least a month with a
Oh
lower
no.
body injury. Without them, though, the Ducks did have basically the same results against the Michigan schools as UW. And junior forward Kwame Evans Jr. is having a breakthrough campaign. He's someone I believe is an NBA prospect, so one should be interesting to see how much he can carry Oregon in this one. But this is one that, like, the Huskies, they're still projected to go 9-11 in Big Ten play by KenPom, because just the schedule is going to break at some point here. It's not going to come for real until after the Illinois game, but they got to take care of business against all the lesser teams in the Big Ten, and right now Oregon is one of those lesser teams.
All right. Let's hope they do it.
All right, let's wrap up quickly with
There's more?
UW football.
Okay, let's do this fast. I have to go pick up a child from school.
A handful of notifications have
Right this second.
transferred. They added Kennesaw State wide receiver Christian Moss, who's got good size at 6'3", 199, had a breakthrough campaign in 2025 with 45 catches for 689 yards and two touchdowns after entering the season with 20 career catches. He began in 2020 at Virginia Tech, playing sparingly in his redshirt freshman campaign before spending 2023 dealing, or 2022, I should say, yeah, 2023 dealing with an injury. According to his Virginia Tech bio, was planning to major in, quote, sports media and analytics, which
You're
was not a
mad.
program I knew existed
You're
for the
mad at him.
time.
You're like, stay off my lane.
Oh, no, we
All
welcome. The more the
right.
merrier.
Okay. All right.
A couple of new reported notifications of transfer. Also at the wide receiver position, Kevin Green Jr., who originally figured to be a key part of the rotation following Jed Fish from Arizona, but missed 2024 due to injury and was bumped down the depth chart by the young receivers last season and ultimately did not record a catch at UW. And kicker Ethan Mazalski, the Spokane native, spent one season at UW as a walk-on kickoff specialist and was effective in that role. But the arrival of two scholarship kickers figured to spell the end of his time on the roster, and he went right back to Illinois, where he from where he had transferred.
Maxulski.
Oh no! So there you go.
The pain we felt for that one.
It was rapid because he did not. There was not a report he was entering the transfer portal. It was just a report
Do
that
not contact Maxulski.
he was headed to, had committed to Illinois.
There we go. Hey, tampering. Come on.
I think we'll all be okay. I don't know. We'll be
Start the
okay.
investigation.
We'll be okay on this. I don't know if we'll all be okay after Sunday. That is TBD in the emergency
I'll
pod
be
on
okay.
Sunday night. On that note,
Thanks for listening.
thanks. I know we haven't done the over-unders yet. I've looked at them. You do not want to see them. They
Just
are
me
not
or
you
all of us?
specifically. All of us. It is a horror film, and you know my feelings about horror films.
Oh my God. That is like the worst part about the Seahawks run is that we don't get to look at those as soon as possible. You know, the Seahawks end of year pod after they win the Super Bowl is not going to be as fun. It's like
Not
Nick
gonna hit
Saban
nearly
with
as hard.
recruiting. When you win the national
Exactly.
championship, you lose a few weeks in recruiting
Exactly.
behind the
Chris
ball.
Signetti weirdly didn't seem as concerned.
Recruiting's a little different now than it was then.
That's a lot different now.
It is, I mean, kind of funny that they already have like their quarterback for next year from the transfer portal before this quarterback is gone.
Yes, before he has completed his Heisman Trophy winning campaign.
It's a little bit of a strange setup. Luca, I came downstairs yesterday. Actually, I came home or whatever from something. And on 2K, you can like download rosters or make rosters from other teams.
Okay.
And he has like a full UW Husky men's roster that is in there. And I'm like, did you download this from somewhere? And he's like, no, I made it. I'm pretty proud of this, which also sounds like a very you as a child thing to do.
Oh yeah.
And it
I
looked pretty
mean,
good too. Like the
editing
play.
Baseball Simulator.
Yeah, like the players, I would say across the board looked pretty good. But I was like, did you download this? And he was like, no, they do not have one for this. And I was like, do they have it for other teams? He's like, yeah, they have it for most other teams across college.
Well, then maybe, I guess, if you're doing a little double checking there and then find a way to upload it. You could be the one creating the
That's what I was
roster.
asking him if he could upload it. I don't know. I do not understand the logistics of how this works.
Oh,
But I
well,
was like, is it
Tristan
funny to
Wash
you
confirmed.
that you are the only person on the face of the earth who is interested in playing as the UW men's Husky basketball team in NBA 2K? There's like Xavier teams out there. There's the fucking
Oh,
Cincinnati Bearcats. Like, there are so.
those are teams with enormous fan bases. Yeah, like
And for the Huskies,
what
they've
you need
got
to tell me
Luka.
is like it should be like there's the William and Mary team,
I bet
there's
there are. Those are
the
teams in
Campbell
the North. I
University
love that you're like, well, we
Tigers.
can't compete with Xavier.
We
We're all
can't. What
a
do
Big Ten
you
program. But I do love the idea of something where it's like you're the only person on the face of the earth who is interested in this thing. It's not like there's a group of people. It's like it is just me. And it is just Luka who at the very least is interested enough in this and has done the work to actually make the roster for them. So I was just thinking about those like moments where you have, and I feel like you've had these things along the way also, where it's like, am I the only person in this place? Or sometimes Mateo will be like, am I the smartest about whatever, like some rap music thing at the age of 8 in Washington State? Or he'll be like, in my school. And I'm like, definitely in your school. And he'll be like, in the district. And I'm like, almost certainly yes. And like, if you just stretch it out far enough, it's like, how far am I the only person who is interested in this thing? And for Luca and the men's college basketball team being in 2K, it is the entire world. The rest of the world has rejected this notion.
All right, I have up the KenPom list of committed fans.
There's a KenPom list of committed fans?
I'll put this in the post notes. So
how is that a thing? Is that on behind the paywall?
Yes.
Okay.
I think. And you can pick a team and then it like shows you them at the top of the page and it shows you their next opponent. You know, it's actually probably more for the coaching staffs than it actually is for the fans. But anyways, I am obviously a committed UW fan. Where do you think among Division I schools, there are like 350 different schools that have at least one committed fan. Where do you think UW ranks?
140.
Oh, that was too low. I mean, Xavier is way higher than you think. Xavier is in Cincinnati as well. They are weirdly have precisely the same percentage.
Really?
They are tied, but
is it a percentage or a ranking?
It's a percentage of all fans, but you should be guessing the ranking because knowing what the percentage
140
is.
140 was too low. You made it seem like you're like literally their fan base extends to Luca.
140. Oregon State is like 140. That's kind of disappointing for them. I have some questions about the Beaver.
Do they
fans
not
based
remember
on that.
The era of all these European players hitting threes against the Huskies? I feel like they must have had some fans during that
the
time.
The Cougs even relatively are punching way above that at 85th.
Are they number 90? Or no, you said 85th? 60th?
They're in the top 60.
Okay. 45th.
Lower than that.
50.
They are 54th.
Okay, that's not terrible.
They are tied with a school that Lorenzo Romar once coached.
St. Louis. And,
yes. So that's the territory we're talking about. They're actually shockingly close to BYU, which is a very good team that has a possible number one pick in the NBA draft.
I think BYU has a lot of fans, and I don't think those fans are looking at KenPom.
Very plausible, I would say. Not everyone, like I don't know that Michigan is actually the biggest fan base in the country, but they are number one.
Yeah, it's also like the amount of people who are like Michigan fans who are pulling up that KenPom every day. Like that is a large amount of people. So I do think it's a little bit skewed.
Okay, but they are
Husky fan base is waiting to be activated, is what I would say.
I suppose that is fair.
I do think they exist.
They're ahead of Oregon, actually.
Hello.
I guess just based on sheer size and, you know.
Their football stadium holds 8,000 strong, so the basketball arena must be like 1,600, I would guess.
Matthew Knight is, if it's not bigger than Heckad, it's very close.
It's bigger than the Otten?
No. Then... this is such a preposterous
we've sold out every game, 600 tickets.
They're not as educational prowess, academic prowess, I should say, as UW. So.
It was funny walking into the Husky game last Wednesday. The children are like, this feels like more people than a football game. And Luke is like, this is like 60,000 less people.
it truly is.
It's not just less people. It is less people by degrees of magnitude.
Matthew Knight Arena seats 12,541. So that is way, it's almost precisely 10, I'm pretty sure.
That is a packed in 10 too.
Oh no, it's smaller even than that. It's 9,268. Yeah.
Heck, it's small. I don't.
Look, we already talked about this, I'm sure.
I had another thought there. Well, whatever.
Dynamite podcasting. Would you lose this?
We're just talking. This is the post pod talk.
It's true.
they're definitely waiting to be activated. Those fans, though, I think. I also think BYU is like one of the few teams that are like a truly national fan base.
But that's why it's weird. They're barely ahead of UW.
Yeah. So I think it's part of like UW hasn't been that good in the known KenPom era that any UW fans are like checking it out.
It would be interesting.
Oh, the
to,
other
like,
thought that I had.
It would be interesting to compare this to enrollment. Like Gonzaga has to have the highest percentage of, you know, relative to their enrollment because they're 12th in this.
And they graduate 60 students per year. They're like a small town like elementary school.
don't know that they're exactly
if they were a school, they'd be like one of those buildings, like a schoolhouse. You know what I mean? Like there's one building where every single kid is like elementary, middle school, and a high school together, and they all know each other.
It's a lovely campus. It's not as small as you are making it out to be, but it is also not the University of Washington.
I mean, their enrollment's about the same as Autzen Stadium holds, but like the the thing that I was thinking about, it was this was on the Discord, the jerseys that Wazoo has that are like Sonics based jerseys, and it's just like, how bad is UW athletics that they can't even, that we're giving this up to the Cougs? Or I'm like, can't we do anything? Like UW athletics, everything they do, and this does not extend to basketball, of course, aside from being pretty good at football and soccer, other tertiary sports, good at that. Women's basketball, maybe a little bit on track. Some other sports on track on the field.
You heard the update earlier. Definitely on track.
UW sports is so bad at every other aspect of this that they gave up having even like the Sonics jerseys. Like, we could have owned that. The UW basketball did nothing after the Sonics moved to solidify themselves as Seattle's basketball team.
That is accurate. I don't think it would have been a good idea for UW to do the Sonics jerseys. I think
you
the whole
don't
point
think
is for
it
like
would have.
Did my whole argument for the athletic department is that they need to come up with their own new things, and this
no,
is by
they're,
definition
they're terrible
not
about that
a
too.
New thing.
No, we've talked about that with the songs where it's like they want this, they want to do all the things that everybody else is doing.
They see someone else's tradition and like, why not us, as opposed to like being the ones who are like, hey, let's create a new tradition.
Or even like, I think they've hit the greatest setting thing a little bit more. Like they've
hit that.
No, but that's what we should be doing. We should be basically branding the stuff that they're already doing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like Captain Husky is a thing where it's like that should be in like the college football video games or something. But we don't do a good enough job about talking about the things that we do either.
I would agree with that.
So it's a little bit of like, let's not try to do the same thing as every other.
So
program.
What you're saying is the UW athletic department should be out there putting together the roster for 2K.
They actually should, though. Should they not?
That was a legitimate suggestion. I mean, I don't know what the rules are around that, but
at the very least, a person in it could do it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's not like there's like, it wouldn't be necessarily from the University of Washington.
Right.
But just being in that game where I was like, all the contests are just weird and hard to understand. Like, it's the whole process of being at a Husky basketball game reminds me of the why do we even watch college basketball.
I definitely had that time,
but I had a great time. As I said earlier, I had a great time at the game.